I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the third episode in our series of podcasts on satire for the London Review of Books. I'm Claire Bucknell, I'm a Fellow of All Souls, Oxford, and I'm joined again by Colin Burrow.
Hello.
Also a Fellow of All Souls. And today, Colin, we are being exceptionally brave and venturing forward into the 17th century.
Scary terrain.
There be dragons. And we left satire in a bad way at the end of our last episode. Elizabethan satire seemed to have so much promise. It was both a shaggy, wild woodland creature and a jumbled plate of goodies. There was so much rudeness in it. It was all great.
And then you banned it. Or it was banned and burned by the Archbishop of Canterbury, which was performed memorably by Claire Bucknell in June 1599.
I did do that. So basically all we've got left to talk about is a steaming pile of burnt books.
Yep, absolutely. But we've got to remember that satire is a kind of phoenix that rises always from the ashes. And I suppose what happened at the beginning of the 17th century is that satire more or less migrated to the stage. So John Marston, Ben Jonson, and even Shakespeare actually all wrote satirical dramas which picked up on a lot of the preoccupations and the tricks of the printed verse satires which the bishops had burnt only a few months before or a couple of years before. So you get cuckolds, you get wives of merchants desperate to get off with courtiers, you get old fools, none of those present, and spry young sons, courtiers who sell all their fields to buy suits, corrupt lawyers, the whole gamut of filthy, extreme stuff that had figured in verse satire gets onto the stage. And you also get, of course, vigorous mutual abuse exchanged among satirical dramatists.
Okay, and today we'll be talking about Ben Jonson, of whom all that was particularly true, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, well, introduce us to Jonson. How does he fit into the bigger story we're telling about English satire? And how does the play we're going to talk about today, Volpone of 1606, fit into that story?
Well, I suppose the first thing I should do is explain a bit about Jonson's historical reputation. And the second thing I might do is explain why I think that reputation is more or less entirely false.
Very bold start, but go on.
Yeah, well, okay, the reputation. So by the second decade of the 17th century, Jonson had in effect made a reputation for himself, which persisted at least into the last century, among critics at least. And according to this, he is basically the big, fat, solid, classical alternative to Shakespeare. And Shakespeare warbles his native woodnotes wild, and Jonson follows classical rules, creates dramas that follow the principles which literary critics were extracting from Roman comedy, which came to be called the unities of time, place, and persons. And Jonson, so the story goes, was also vitally interested, and Shakespeare wasn't, which is, I think, not true, in having his plays and poems published. So in 1616, Ben Jonson published a folio, which is to say just a big expensive volume, of his own works, as he called them.
And 1616, at this point, he's still alive.
Yep.
He carried on, despite several strokes, until right into the reign of Charles I, not long before the Civil War. He dies in 1637, whereas Shakespeare dies the year that Jonson publishes that works in 1616. And contrary to what you just said, we should note that hardly any living author had published a volume called Works until that time.
Absolutely. And those who did so wouldn't have included plays among their works in the way Jonson did, as well as poems. I mean, so people would publish volumes called Works, which included poems. But making plays for the popular stage into something you call works was totally Jonson. So that was a big statement. And the folio of Shakespeare's comedies, histories and tragedies, so that doesn't include poems at all, wasn't published until 7 years later, in 1623, well after Shakespeare's death. And in some respects, that volume was an imitation of Jonson's great big statement of 1616. And of course, the Shakespeare First Folio wasn't put together by Shakespeare, it's put together by a couple of actors called Hemmings and Condell, whom we will meet actually later in this podcast, I think.
Yes, we will. Okay, so that's Johnson's reputation. What do you think, Colin Burrow, that view gets wrong?
Well, the key thing to remember about Johnson is that he was probably more than anybody else in this period, actually, or any author in this period, a self-invention. So he deliberately set about constructing an image for himself through the 1616 folio. And I have a copy of the folio sitting here on my desk, although unfortunately it's only the second folio of 1640, which reprints the first. And the thing that he did was to put right at the start of the volume a work that made him look like the great classical reformer of the English stage. So we open the 1616 folio, and the first thing we see is a massively ornate title page bearing a whole load of representations of allegorical figures called things like comedy and tragedy. But if you look, Claire, at the top left of the page, we'll do some realistic crinkling of 400-year-old paper.
I mean, it's seriously real paper.
Yeah.
So what you see at the top left is a figure of a satyr who is labelled satyr, in case you didn't get it, with what looks like a tree coming out of his head and a sort of giant phallus staff thing. And because he's at the top left, if you read the page as you do from left to right and top to bottom, satyr is the first thing you see above comedy and tragedy.
So it's sort of saying, I begin with satyr. And if you follow on from the title page, there are pages of dedications by very famous people of Johnson's works, and dedicatory poems by Johnson's friends, which usual sort of thing. But if you go to the first bit of actual Ben Johnson in the volume, it starts with the prologue to Every Man in His Humour.
Okay, well that makes sense. That play was performed in 1598. That's the beginning of Johnson's career as a playwright. So begin at the beginning, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm all in favour of beginning at the beginning. But And Every Man in His Humour was an early play, but it actually wasn't Johnson's first. And it was also a play which Johnson revised, probably for publication in the folio. And it's pretty certain that he added the prologue to it, probably for the folio. And the prologue basically says to the world, I'm better than Shakespeare, and I understand all the rules which underlie classical dramas. And unlike him, and unlike pretty much everyone else, whom I won't deign to name, I won't write history plays which in the tiring house bring wounds to scars, and I won't fight over York and Lancaster's long jars, and so on.
Which is a reference to the Wars of the Roses, about which Shakespeare had, of course, composed the Henry VI plays. And the problem, it was believed, with trying to dramatise the events of long historical periods like that one, was this idea that we touched on earlier about classical drama and the restriction of the unity of time, which is about restricting your action to a 24-hour period on stage.
Yeah. And the Henry VI plays, of course, cover about half a century, which is several 24-hour periods. Shall we agree on that?
I believe it is.
I can't do the maths.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Johnson starts out the folio implying that Shakespeare and the rest are inherently unruly and unclassical. And in some ways, the cruelest thing about that is that Shakespeare actually acted in Every Man in His Humour. And he figures in the cast list, which in the second folio is directly facing this prologue, which is giving the bird to Shakespeare, you know, there is his name as one of the principal comedians. So Johnson is really standing up against the world from the very first moment of the first folio. And he says that he will write of deeds and language such as men do use, and persons such as comedy would choose, when she would show an image of the times and sport with human follies, not with crimes.
Which means, in effect, that he's saying he's going to be doing satire.
Yeah, so he begins with satire. And the very tangled plot of Every Man in His Humour is basically a romp through the absurdities of London life of a kind that is very, very like the satires of the 1590s. So, you know, you've got a top dressing of classical comedy with an old father spying on his son, but you've got young wags about town and a catalogue of satirical London types sort of frolicking around smoking tobacco and doing various Elizabethan things like that.
And then the second play in the folio, no prizes for guessing which, is Every Man Out of His Humour. And that one, let's have a look. Colin's just turning the page as we speak.
There,
dramatic.
Yeah,
There it is. Okay, so this one is dedicated in the folio to the Inns of Court. And that was that key milieu, as we saw in the last episode, for the composition of verse satires, John Donne, Marston, etc.
Yep. And actually more than that, because on the title page of Every Man Out, it is described as, ta-da, a comical satire. Yeah. So he is producing these satirical dramas immediately in the aftermath of the ban, because the Every Man Out of His Humour was first published in 1600, while Marston satires were still smouldering on the bishop's bonfire, or Clare Bucknell's bonfire, that had started burning in June 1599.
Okay, I see where we're going with this. So what you're arguing is that Jonson's latter-day reputation as this austere neoclassical dramatist was a kind of retrospective construction that he built for himself through the way in which he presented his works in this big folio of 1616.
Yeah, but I'm also saying something else, that Jonson sort of dressed himself up as a classical dramatist, and for centuries literary critics more or less swallowed that self-representation whole without questioning it, as they should have done. And Jonson at heart was also a very different kind of dramatist who was completely immersed in the sort of scuzzy and volatile and unruly energies of late Elizabethan London. So he was reading and absorbing popular pamphlets about crooks and what were called in the slang of the time coney catchers, or urban thieves who preyed on gullible countrymen. And they are basically the substance of his plots.
And that is also, of course, the world that fed the Elizabethan satirists.
Yeah, the stinky, grimy London that they fed on, really. And, you know, we have very refined critical nostrils, don't we? I'll sniff to illustrate their fineness. And our nostrils are trained to distinguish between the stink and corruption of the city and the desiccated flavours of neoclassical criticism. They're sort of different, but in Jonson, they are absolutely convergent. And I think that's the most important single thing to grasp about him.
Thanks for listening to this extract from On Satire, a close reading series from the London Review of Books. To listen to the full episode and all our other close reading series, sign up to our close reading subscription at lrb.me/close readings, or click on the link in the description.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.